Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we turn the page and consider the conditions at the Garden of Eden, that was not your average story that we ended the last segment talking about. We have Jason who would like to make a comment on it, and I think that because of the poignancy of that story and how it so identifies itself with the corruption that is Islam, it is absolutely worth the added investment of our time to consider its implications as we move into this hour. So, Jason, my friend, welcome to Shattering Myths.
Hi, Ada. Yeah, I was listening to that story, and just awful. Just about brings me to tears, like, right here in the van, you know? And it seems like there's just no limit to how awful, like what level man can be brought to, and
right.
what a gem, you know, the Torah is to mankind.
Yeah, there's several things, Jason, about that story that are extraordinarily important. One is, this was not a man acting alone, just an average corrupt individual, and there's, you know, poisoned people around the world. This was an Islamic preacher. He's an imam. He's trained in the religion. Number two, the Islamic courts in Saudi Arabia were going to exonerate him because they had absolutely no basis for doing anything to him but to exonerate him because the nature of the Quran and Hadith and Sharia law have no punishment for being a rapist, for being a pedophile, for being incestuous, all of which are approved in Islam, or for abusing and beating a female or killing her. Everything he did was acceptable in Islam, following Muhammad's example.
Yeah.
The story, though, of one little girl being raped by her religious father and then being beaten, burned, had her fingernails pulled out, had her ribs beaten, had her skull crushed in, electric shock, to suffer another 10 months in the hospital, and then finally succumb to those wounds perpetrated by her father that did this to her because she wasn't a virgin, because he had raped her. The story of one individual suffering like that is much more powerful, Jason, than the story that preceded it, which talked about 50 people being murdered by a suicide bomber and four times that number having their bodies mutilated by suicide bombers all across Iraq, and 6,000 people dying from suicide bombers in Iraq, and another 100,000+ having their bodies mutilated and burned by suicide bombers. It's the poignancy of the individual act of horror that really identifies the nature of this religion.
Yeah, and, you know, the politically correct, you know, like the way that this is spawned in the media. Horrors like this. And
right.
even, you know, I've posted links to Prophet of Doom on my Facebook from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had somebody was a friend of mine in high school, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, they jump back with, you know, this is anti-Islamic propaganda.
Yeah.
Are you okay? And all this. And, you know, I can see why considers it appropriate, or it's set up
mm-hmm.
in a way that the ignorant are destroyed.
Yes.
Because they are just as destructive.
Correct.
As the people yeah. perpetrating.
And that is that's the beauty of it. Your high school pal read from a book that is based entirely on the five oldest and most credible Islamic sources. It does. Prophet of Doom doesn't use any source other than the Quran, and the four Hadith sources that are considered the most authentic and the earliest that were comprised. That's it. Five sources. They are Islam's five most credible and oldest sources. And yet, when your friend was confronted by how just disgusting that the Quran and Hadith are, and Muhammad's words and deeds were, rather than respond, wow, I had no idea the religion was that bad, He instead used an ad hominem attack and took the approach of, you know, this is from a Islamophobe.
And Yada, because of that, there are other consequences. My daughter's 9 years old. I teach her carefully, but with discretion.
Yes.
A little bit about the dangers surrounding Islam and the dangers of Muslim culture.
Yeah, particularly of Muslim men, because they can kill her legitimately. Can kill her. They can torture. They can do what they were just done here. If she would submit to marrying a Muslim man and go off to live in an Islamic country, her fate could be identical. And there's nothing anyone could do to protect her.
And the sad part is it's here in the West.
Sure.
Because of the climate, the politically correct climate and the parrot media, the thing is that she will go to school with that information. And now
right.
She doesn't just have one
right.
enemy. She's got two.
Correct.
She's got the Muslims who
right.
want to destroy
right.
her freedoms and, put her under these kind of horrors.
And the politically correct.
And the politically correct who defend them and protect
right.
them.
Right.
They are just as
right.
dangerous, just
yeah.
as destructive.
Yeah, and
I
agree with you.
Just that Yahweh would destroy.
He will.
The ignorant.
Yeah, it's going to his return, because he will come back undiminished, will instantly vaporize them, because he's coming back as pure energy, and therefore his arrival will instantly vaporize those who are not enveloped in his set apart spirit. Now, I happen to concur with you that the problem with political correctness, which is now indoctrinated two generations of Americans, so that Americans lack, and this is the same thing is true in Europe, they lack the capacity to be moral. Because they're no longer judgmental, they can't be just, they can't be civil, they can't be moral. And they end up accepting things that are ruthless. And when you are merciful to a ruthless doctrine, then you're no different than those who rallied around and went to the vast parades and ceremonies of the Nazis. And yeah, absolutely. You're a catalyst that enables the ruthless to be merciless. And so, you know, I would view those in the West who accept Islam, who lie on behalf of Islam, who don't bother to study Islam and misrepresent it and misrepresent this war on terror as a war on terror, a tactic as opposed to Islam declaring war on all mankind, that the death of this little girl, the death of everyone that Islam has savaged, 110,000 in Syria, it's a stain on their soul. It's a sign that they have lost the capacity to be moral. You know, you need to be a rational, moral, just, reasonable individual. You have to be able to process information in a discriminating manner. Yeah, to make connections
with God's perspective. Otherwise, you are going to corrupt other people around you. You are going
right.
to just, you know, be a catalyst for, you know.
You know, if America had exposed and condemned Islam for what Islam had done through the PLO and through the terrorist bombings around the world that preceded 9/11, if America had politicians and religious leaders and academicians that studied the religion to find out why it was committing acts of terror, which is what I did. I spent 10,000 hours becoming an expert on the Islamic religious scriptures. And if they had done that and said, well, this is the problem. Muhammad was a terrorist. He did these things, and Muslims are ordered to follow his example. And the Quran says that if you're a peaceful Muslim, you cease to be a Muslim, and good Muslim jihadists have to kill you. Under that circumstances, there is no reforming Islam. There is no way to live in a world where Muslims are empowered or enabled to perpetrate jihad without them destroying everyone. And so if we had people who spoke out against the religion, 9/11 wouldn't have been possible. They would not have been able to come here and train in schools and maintain that they were, over that period of time, that they were doing something that was good in a culture that overtly exposed how demented and perverted Muhammad was and how unbelievably stupid the Quran is. They would no longer have the motivation to do what they did.
Yeah, I got to go, but I just wanted to part with that, you know, you hear a story like this and the promise of the judgment of God, anger of
yes.
God poured
yes.
out, it's actually comfort to me.
Yeah, it is. And in this particular case, because the man was an Islamic preacher, he will be held accountable. You know, God, I don't think, punishes crimes that don't lead people away from him. Those lives just simply cease to exist. But anyone engaged in the practice of misleading, of pretending to be enlightened and actually lying, that those are the people that God says specifically, I'm going to judge. This man is assured of spending his eternity with Allah, the very wannabe God that he served. He's going to get his wish. He will spend eternity with Allah. He's just not going to like it very much.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason.
Bye.
We're going to turn now to the story that we've been covering in the Torah. It is the first story that we're told after God explains how he created the universe. And we have regaled in all of the dimensions of Adam's nature, Chawa's nature, of the conditions that existed in the garden and how they model the covenant relationship that Yahweh wants to establish with us. And then we transition to God making certain that Adam and Chawa were free to choose, that they could choose to have a relationship with God or they could choose to reject him. Choice is essential to love. It is essential to relationship. We'll focus on that choice when Shattering Myths returns in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm Yada. We're turning now to Yahweh making certain that Adam and Chawa were not robots, that they had the opportunity to listen to an alternative to listening to him, that if they wished to reject his instruction, they had the free will to do so. You know, in America, and Dan and I were talking during the break as to the myth that, you know, America is the freest nation on earth, and yet I could point to dozens of reasons to show that that's not true. We have the illusions of freedom. God's not into illusions. He created us so that we can engage in a relationship with him. But that relationship has to be entirely our choice. God's not going to intimidate us into it. He's not going to compel us into it. He's not going to strong-arm us into it. He's not going to keep the alternative choice at bay so that you don't have the opportunity to consider it either. You know, in a dictatorship, all of the Islamic countries, most communist countries, they control the media. Even in a fascist country like Russia today, people's access to information is constrained because the dictator doesn't want people to understand anything that might be superior about an alternative. There is no real freedom when that exists. Yahweh is serious about freedom. He gave us the gift of free will. And it's not just that he gave us the gift. He also made it possible for us to use it. If you don't want to have a relationship with him, that is your choice. If you wish to oppose him, that is your choice. You can do that too. If you want to embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant and engage in a relationship with him, then he has committed to give all of its benefits to you. But so that free will would be legitimate, not an illusion, Yahweh allowed Satan in the form of, and this is not a real snake, we're talking about a metaphor here, a cold-blooded, venomous creature, allowed Hasatan to slither into the garden. The garden was protected. Outside the garden, death and dying. All forms of animals, all forms of decay, all forms of savagery. It was life as we know it. Red in tooth and claw outside of the garden. Inside of the garden, protective enclosure, conducive to life, perfect happiness. But there was a choice, that tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If you wish to reject God's guidance, eat from it. That would be your option. But just having it there wasn't really fair in the sense of giving humankind a viable way to exercise free will. There needed to be an advocate for choosing not God. And so God allowed Satan to slither into the garden. Now, Satan is not presented by God as being hideously ugly. He's not presented like religious caricatures have, Satan menacing and drooling and vicious looking and ugly and presenting himself as the devil. That's not how Satan presents himself. He never presents himself as the devil. Allah's modeled after Satan. Satan wants to be considered God. Satan is the Lord of Christianity. He's the Lord of most religions. He's the antithesis of God. That's the reason he is called the Lord. God says he will be reasonable and cunning. More than any living thing relative to the open field, that's the area outside of the garden, that Yahweh God had made. God had to create a spirit that was opposed to him for free will to be viable. So what's the first thing he did? Satan said to the woman, indeed, so what if God said that you shall not eat from any tree in the protected garden enclosure? That's the nature of every religion. So what if God said? When the whole nature of Roman Catholicism is that the edicts of the church and canon law, church law is what matters. So what if God said something else? We're empowered to make up our own rules. That's the nature of Judaism. Rabbi said, these are our arguments, this is our law, so what if God said that? This is what we say. Islam is, so what if God authored the Torah? This is what he says now. Paul's Christianity. So what if God authored that Torah? It enslaves, it's not for you. But I, Paul, say this, that, and the other thing. So what if God said? That was the first approach. If you choose to ignore what God said, there's going to be a consequence. Welcome to reality. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. The next line we read after Hasatan saying, so what if God said, is the woman said to the serpent, Satan, we can eat the fruit from the trees in the protected garden enclosure, but from the fruit of the tree, which relationally is in the middle of the sheltered garden, God said, do not eat from that one, do not even touch it, lest you die. Larry has joined us here, and over the previous programs, Larry, I've made several comments here. One is that God's instruction was known to the woman. So she was without excuse. Number two, she did what God asked us not to do. She subtracted from God's testimony. God specifically called that one tree the knowledge of good and evil. He had already made everything that was good known to them, so all they were going to gain was the ingestion of evil if they neglected his testimony. So she subtracted that from God's testimony, and then she added, don't even touch it. When you add and subtract from God's testimony, bad things happen.
Sure. We end up with religious institutions. We end up getting on man's path as opposed to Yah's path. Yeah, we see that in billions and billions of people.
Yep.
In fact, they'll use the propaganda technique of, you know, the old bandwagon. Well, billions of people can't be wrong. Well, if billions of people can't be wrong, Yah was wrong because he said, you know, there's a small, and Yahusha, you know, there's a small group of people on this real narrow path. They're the correct ones, not you billions.
Yeah. In fact, when I wrote Prophet of Doom, and initially, I mean, I haven't been to the Prophet of Doom site, look at the email. Probably in 3 months. You know, I was on so much satanic stuff I could handle, and I was editing Questioning Paul, so it was just beyond my appetite.
Yeah, I have to take my hat off to you for even being able to wade through that garbage that long. It's just amazing.
Yeah, amazing. But anyway, I did respond to them, and as I was responding to them, almost every Muslim would try to justify Islam, not to refute anything that was written in Prophet of Doom, because they can't refute it, because it all comes from the Islamic Quran and Hadith, but they'd always say that Islam can't be wrong because it's the world's fastest growing and largest religion. Well, you know, if that's the case, then Roman paganism was the truth, and before that it would be Greek paganism, and before that it might be Babylonian or Egyptian paganism that were the truth.
Last three, it was Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini and Mao.
Right.
They were all correct.
Sure. Yeah, obviously in China, Mao's little red book was the most popular way to go, so it must have been true. You know, to debate truth based on popularity, that's why God says that the way to death and destruction is popular, and the way to life and to relationship is very unpopular. It goes against the crowd. Truth has never been popular. It will eventually be popular, but we're 20 years away. Yeah, give it 20 years or so, and it will be possible.
It will be.
Yeah. So here's the next statement. It says, the venomous reptile said to the woman, you shall not die a physical death. Well, he was lying to her. She would die a physical death. And she did die a physical death. Now, I think there's reason to conclude that Adam and Chawa, in fact, there's a lot of insights provided relative to Adam and Chawa, that they availed themselves of Kara, which was God's invitation to reconcile their relationship with him. And even though they were now no longer enjoying the great joy of the garden, but were now exposed to evil because they made that choice, you know, the Torah's teaching is designed to bring us back into fellowship with God, and that is what the choice they ultimately made. But both Adam and Chawa would die. But I'm convinced that both of them are now part of the covenant and therefore continuing to live as part of God's family. But here's Satan. He didn't say, you know, you misquoted the big guy. You know, that's not actually what he told you. He just rolled with it, you know. She misquoted him, added to, subtract from, and he played right off of it. It's why I'm unwilling to blame Satan for inspiring Muhammad or Paul in the creation of Christianity or Islam. Either of those two guys, of their own volition, would have done what they did. They made a choice. Satan certainly used them. He certainly expounded upon what they said. He certainly found the soft spots to make the religions credible, appealing, and yet especially beguiling and destructive. But they made their choice. You know, we all too often blame Satan for the things that we ourselves have chosen to do. Now, Satan went on to say,
Yahweh promoted the choice. Yahweh doesn't live in the future, in the past. He doesn't have the present or the future. He sees them all at the same time. He lives outside the construct of light. Right. I mean, he invented light. And he used Satan as a punk. He punked him.
Yes.
So instead of these two people being captive in a closure, now they had to make a choice.
Right.
Which
they were free.
Which is all Yahweh wants any of us to do, which is to choose him.
It was kind of interesting, Larry, but you're right. They were freed from the garden.
Yep.
They were freed from the garden. So they were no longer inmates. They were no longer a bird in a cage. They were freed from the garden. They made that choice. They were freed from the garden. We've all been freed from the garden. And whether or not we choose to avail ourselves of the doorway back into the garden is a choice we all have to make. We can all, Passover is the doorway back into the garden of life. The threshold that cleanses us of the scum of religion and politics and the death and dying outside the garden is matzah on yeasted bread. And those who avail themselves of those two offers become Bukodim, firstborn children, back into the covenant, right back in the garden. And they made that choice. You and I have made that choice. We do this program because we would encourage, but not compel, others to make that choice. Come to know what God said and respond to it rationally. Make your own decision as to whether or not you want to walk back into that door. Because right now you're outside of it. Well, not everyone listening to this program. Most people listening to this program have made that choice. They know Yah is Dad and are inside. But, of course, this program is also shared with many people who are unaware that there even is a doorway named Passover.
Yeah, even though Yahusha, who they misnamed Jesus, said there's a small doorway you enter.
Right.
Which is obviously the seven Moed Mikre, and
right.
You enter the door at Passover or Pesach.
Right.
Yeah.
And sure. And immediately thereafter, you benefit from having your soul perfected, having the yeast, the fungus of yeast, removed. And he even explained that the yeast that is being removed is religious and political corruption.
Yeah. Well, they even corrupted in the religious book, you know, that Yahusha was dead in a tomb for 3 days.
Right, right.
He said he was fulfilling the three Moed Mikra, but the word that he used was cardia. Now
right.
that means the center of the circulation of life, which was at that time was Jerusalem.
Right.
Now when I say I'm in the center of the circulation of life,
yeah.
You know, here in Jacksonville,
yeah,
Florida,
right.
Which
right.
is town center, do you automatically think I'm in a graveyard?
No. No,
for 3 days?
No,
no. It's copy edited.
Yeah.
So Christians all think he was dead in a tomb, which throws them off, walking in the Pesach door, going right to matzah, and the third day, you know, Bikurim. He was fulfilling the three Moed, which is exactly what he said he did, exactly what he said he was going to do.
And, of course, that's why in the Friday evening, the Shabbat show that we do on Yareya Radio on BTR, that we spoke about the Habakkuk prophecy, where God names Paul by name and condemns him, calling him the plague of death. But one of the things
that was 666 years before Paul, you know.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, Habakkuk was written. Yeah, 666
wow.
years exactly before Galatians, Paul's first epistle was written. But what God said is that this fellow is going to promote the idea that God can die. And God says in the prophecy, God, I can't die. I mean, if there is one truth, universal truth, as it relates to a spiritual being, is this spirit cannot die. I cannot die. And so the very basis of Christianity, that God died for your sins, is opposed to God's nature and his testimony.
And we all know energy can only be transformed. You know?
Yes. Energy can be transformed into a physical state. And it can be transformed from a physical state back into energy. It cannot be destroyed.
Yeah.
This goes on to say, because truly the Almighty knows that indeed in the day that you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will exist like God, knowing and being aware and acknowledging good and bad. A highly beguiling statement based upon a corruption of the truth. He was giving the impression that something was going to change other than just having access to bad. And while they were going to now have access to bad and ingest evil, they didn't know it because they were going to be freed from the garden. Their eyes already were open. God created us with eyes so we could be observant. Their ears were already open. She heard what God had to say so we could listen. That our minds were already open because God gave Adam the uniqueness of Adam and Chawa as they had a Nesama, a conscience that enabled us to process information rationally. God already told us that Adam and Chawa were made in his image, in his likeness. So that wasn't going to change either. The only thing that they were going to gain was the ingestion of evil. Doesn't sound like a very good trade, but here Satan was selling something by beguiling them, telling them half-truths. So the woman and wife looked and saw that indeed the tree's fruit was good, even though God said it was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and that indeed it was desirable. Now she wanted, she craved what God had instructed her not to do. And she craved and coveted the tree's insights, its understanding. And she grasped hold of some of the fruit and ate it. Moreover, she immediately gave it to her husband, who was with her, and he ate. The whole concept of the dietary instructions that are in the Torah. God is saying, this stuff is not healthy for you. If you eat it, it's bad for you. God is saying, if you consume evil, if you consume religion and politics and patriotism and militarism and all those sorts of things, it's going to corrupt you.
It'll kill you.
It'll kill you. Yeah. And so that's what God is saying. He's right. And she and he chose to ignore his guidance, and they therefore suffered the consequence. They ate it. Both of their eyes of them were opened, and they recognized that they were indeed naked, so they sewed fig foliage together for a covering. They were no longer covered in the set-apart spirit. They knew that they were flawed for the first time. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. This is the last segment for today, and I am, for those who are listening also to the archives of the show, I will be taking some time off and go visit my son in Texas, my other son in Ohio, and then going to spend a few days back in my farm in Virginia. While I'm back at the farm, I will be able to broadcast on a regular basis. But while we're en route and visiting with my boys, we will be playing archives of this program. So I will not be live. And there are have been times in the past where a good friend here, Larry, has filled in for me. We're making a transition, though, now in terms of the program director, the individual running the board. It's Dan now, and that Dan will typically be doing the show on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. We'll have someone else on the board on Thursday, someone else on Fridays. And while we're making this transitioning, everybody getting to know one another, a little harder for someone to fill in while I'm gone. So I will be gone for next week or so.
Yana, can I bring up a perfect example of what we just talked about here that happened in the garden?
Sure.
This is in Shemoth, or what's it means names, and it's called Exodus today, 2010.
Uh-huh.
But the seventh day of the Sabbath of Yahweh, your Elohim, mm-hmm. you shall yeah. not do any part of the work of God's representatives and messengers.
Right.
Nor not yourself, nor your son, your daughter, your servants and employees, your means of production, and those visitors who relationally are in your home, property, or community.
Right.
Now, that was unambiguous and authoritative, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, what do you suppose the motivation was for this imperial edict? From and this is straight from Constantine's historian, Eusebius.
Right.
He recorded this in 321 CE.
And before you read it, Larry, just so that our listeners know, Constantine is not your average guy. Constantine is the founder of Roman Catholicism. Now, Roman Catholic Church will claim that their religion was founded on Peter being the first pope because of something that Yosha said to him, but Yosha didn't say anything remotely like what they believe he was said, and he would have been overtly opposed to Roman Catholicism. So Roman Catholicism began with Constantine. He was a warrior general. He saw a sign superimposed on his god, which was the sun. He was worshipped Mithras throughout his entire life, died as a pagan sun god worshiper. And he's the founder of Roman Catholicism. So when you read what his historian said, his royal spokesperson said, you're reading the initial edict that was the basis of Roman Catholicism.
And the basis of Christianity today, by the way, because
yes.
that's where it's derived from. All
correct.
Things whatsoever that is the duty to do on the Sabbath, now this is the seventh day of rest,
mm-hmm.
these have been transferred to the Lord's Day. And from the founder of Roman Catholicism called Sunday, Sol Invictus Mithras. And that's the day of the unconquerable sun, Mithras. That's what it means.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Under penalty of death, he declared that all within the empire must cease work on Sunday to honor the sun god.
Sure.
Now, I'm going to go just a little further. And
by correct, yes, that's what he said. You have the history is accurate. That's the basis of Roman Catholicism is to subtract everything that God said, add whatever man wishes to have done, and that is the basis of religion. It's exactly how Satan beguiled Chawa and Adam in the Garden of Eden. It's the consequence, of course, of doing what Constantine said, which is what Roman Catholics and, to a large degree, Christians, emulating them, do today, and going to worship the Lord on Sunday, is death. You're going to die.
Yeah, in the Qumran scrolls, when it's predicting the Son of Man, or Yahusha, he says, the Son of Man strengthens, establishes, restores, renews, and prevails by being resolute and uncompromising, and by the way of his power, steadfast with it. He carefully observes and keeps the Sabbath from being profaned, defiled, or dishonored, carefully keeping him from doing anything harmful or evil, inconsistent with the standards. Now, that's Yasha Yahu, Qumran Scrolls 56.2. Mm-hmm. That's describing Yahusha, the Son of Man.
Right.
Now, I hear Christians misquote Gal Kahn, and I think it is, all the time, where they say, he that believeth in me shall not perish but have everlasting life, or something like that, the King's English. The problem is, Yahusha himself said, how can you say you believe in me and not do what I do?
Yeah, exactly. And he was Torah observant. So if you're going to do what he does, if you're going to follow his example, you have to be Torah observant. And the moment you're Torah observant, you cease to be a Christian. Larry, thank you for the call. Have a wonderful day. May Yah bless.